For those who haven't thought of it yet, now would be an excellent time to turn off your cell phone or mute it. It is my pleasure today to convene the House Interim Revenue Committee.
And likewise, the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue is open as well.
Thank you, Frank. Welcome all. We're going to start today with our quarterly report from Mr. McMullen on our economic and revenue outlook. If you'd come forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, Mr. Vice-Co-Chair, and members of the committee. I'm Mark McMullen, State Economist for the Office of Economic Analysis, joined by my colleague Josh Lehner from the office, as well as Dr. Bill Connerly today from Connerly Consulting. Dr. Connerly plays a very similar role to ours in the private sector, where he provides planning guidance for financial services and other businesses along those lines. Dr. Connerly is also a member of the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors and helps us on a quarterly basis put together this show. Well, since we last appeared before you in May, Oregon's economy and state tax revenues have continued their slow upward climb. But unfortunately, these external risks we talked about then are still big, and in fact, they're not going away at all and may even be getting larger as we go forward. We have the euro crisis, the slowdown among our primary trading partners in Asia, as well as a tremendous amount of certainty about the path of federal government policy going forward. And so now these risks are not only threatening to derail our recovery or our expansion, rather, but now they're also weighing on growth right now. Businesses and households are having just as much trouble handicapping these risks as are we. And as a result, they're proceeding cautiously and taking a wait-and-see attitude, not buying as many cars, putting off long-term investments and hiring. And this is slowing growth throughout the outlook and has caused a broad consensus of economic forecasters to become more pessimistic in recent months. Then we're already starting to see some of these bad outcomes show up in the data in terms of consumer spending, new orders for capital goods, and trade. And in particular, it's the manufacturing, the goods, and the trade that are worrisome, because those are Oregon's comparative advantage, and these are the things that are expected to lead us throughout this business cycle. However, manufacturing and the production of goods is always a very cyclical industry, and they've had a very good run. And so with or without our slowdown with our trading partners and less demand for our goods, we were going to expect some degree of cooling off in manufacturing. Lucky for us, or somewhat lucky, is that we are getting some upward pressure on growth finally from the housing market, that's showing some signs of life. So while we expect this slow growth story to keep going, and that we don't expect the growth rate of Oregon's economy to change much going forward, the drivers of the growth have changed significantly in recent months, where we are getting less support from these goods industries and finally more support from housing, which traditionally is something that lifts us during recoveries and something that we're hoping will continue going forward. Now, this graph I'm putting up takes a look at all of our consensus forecasters and most of the published economic forecasts out there. And when I say universal, it's pretty much universally that everyone's outlook for both the next 2 years has become more pessimistic. And this really was echoed by the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors. And therefore, unlike last spring, we really decided to internalize this downgrade in the forecast. Last spring, the things that were concerning us, housing permits, consumer confidence, interest rate yield curves and things, were less tangible than the things that are hitting now, the retail sales, less orders for durable goods, export slowing. These things are more of a concern, and we believe we need to fold them into our baseline outlook. But for now, our baseline outlook doesn't call for you know, any tremendous worsening. We're looking for some more slow crawling growth. But we can't rule out something considerably better or worse than this outcome. And this is why we asked Dr. Connerly to join us today. Dr. Connerly, again, works with businesses and financial service firms, and our question to him was to ask him how businesses are trying to handicap all of these external risks that are out there, and to what extent, what are they doing to manage this risk as they go forward? And hopefully this can lend you all some insights as well.
Welcome, Dr. Connerly.
Thank you. Good morning, chairs and members. I'd like to begin by telling you what I'm telling my corporate clients and then what I see them doing in reaction to my comments. Imagine it's December 1982 and you're looking at a leader with 25 years of experience, a leader in business or government or nonprofits. In December of 1982, a person with 25 years experience had managed through 5 recessions. Now fast forward to December 2007 and look at the next generation of leadership. A person with 25 years of experience as of December 2007 had managed through 2 recessions. 5 recessions, 2 recessions, and in the more recent case, those 2 recessions were 2 of the mildest on record. This period from the end of 1982 through the end of 2007, go ahead, is we economists call the Great Moderation. It was the calmest era ever in American economic history. This chart shows a 20-quarter moving standard deviation in quarterly changes of GDP, which I'm sure you immediately recognize tells us that when the line is high, the economy is going up and down, and the cycles are really close together. When the line is low, the economy is very calm. There may be technical change, political change, social change, but the business cycles are fairly calm. And I think back at the people who are in leadership today, and we have a few young people, we have a few older people, like me, who remember vividly the recessions of the 70s and the early 80s, but a lot of our leadership learned how to be leaders during the Great Moderation. They learned what items to put on their to-do list, what things to worry about, what things not to worry about. In business, the companies that ignored the risk of recession grew, and they took market share from businesses that were hunkered down worrying about a recession. And I think perhaps in politics, candidates who worried about recession a lot lost elections to those who said, let's just go forward. And so we have an environment that is kind of dialed in for stability. What's going to happen in the future? I think substantially less stability. It would take about an hour to go through the causes of the Great Moderation and the forecast for those specific causes. But my expectation is that the future is going to look more cyclical than the Great Moderation. Not as bad as the 50s or that period in the late 70s, early 80s. But I think we need to expect more cyclicality. The booms will be boomier and the busts will be bustier looking forward. Right now, we have, this is my forecast. It's not far from anybody else's forecast. I'm sorry, this is not mine. This is actually the Federal Reserve of Philadelphia's summary. And there's recently been a downgrading of forecasts. But the base case forecast is like light to moderate growth. It's okay, it's nothing great, but there are substantial risks here. And I don't recall a time when we have such a wide dichotomy between our base case forecast, which is moderate growth, and how bad things could go if things go south. Europe is the biggest one. I probably should have put it in type that's about 8 times the font size of everything else. There's a significant risk of Europe's mild recession becoming a major recession, which would have impacts on us. China's growth is decelerating, and Oregon's dependence on China has been growing as a percentage of our total exports. The fiscal cliff and policy uncertainty are also there. So in this environment, I talked to a lot of business people. I hit them with this, and let me go ahead tell you what I see them doing. The The sales item, and there are some items that might be on the list if this were a business audience, but I don't see a government analogy. So these are the business practices that I think have some kind of government analogy or might have. The sales item, a plastic bag manufacturer was hurt very hard by the recession, and they told me they were really surprised at how badly things turned out, but they learned sort of in a postmortem that their salespeople knew that things were going south long before the management team heard about it. That would be the equivalent to Oregon tax revenues slowing down before anybody either hears about it or anybody acts about it. And I, at the risk of boring you with things that you know, I think it's important to come back to where we were 11 years ago. In August of 2001, early in the 2001-2003 biennium, these committees received an updated economic forecast that showed red ink for the biennium, but just a little bit of red ink in the September 2001 forecast. Everybody said, okay, we'll see what the next forecast does, and I thought that was appropriate personally. Then, 2 weeks later, September 11th, terrorist attacks, and on September 12th, it was pretty obvious the economy was going to be lousy, and as far as I could tell, I'm not in Salem every day, but as far as I could tell, not a lot was happening here. We waited until December's economic forecast came, and it showed a lot of red ink, and it was decided to have special sessions that began in February. But that was a five-month time lag between the bad news and the action on that. And my private sector clients are trying to shorten that time lag between bad news and action. And the faster you react to bad news or good news, the faster you react, the more moderate the reaction need be. On finance, it's pretty much a no-brainer. Every business is trying to be more cautious, build up greater cash reserves, borrow less. Interest rates for creditworthy borrowers, business or consumers, are so low they're almost free. But I see companies hesitant to borrow. They are being very cautious. On employees, a hesitancy, aside from high-tech mining and agriculture, a hesitancy to hire employees. If there's more work to be done, use contractors. Because of this fear that recession may be coming and wanting to be flexible to deal with the recession. On capital projects, they want to be modular. And what we mean by that is instead of one really great big plant, it's like, let's build a small plant and then add on as we see things going. Let's reduce the risk of a big project by doing a small one and add on. Maybe more expensive in the long run, but again, provides flexibility. And there are also companies laying out hard cash to have greater flexibility in their manufacturing operations. One company has pulled out its manufacturing line, replaced it with new equipment, just because the new equipment allows it to shift so that in the morning they produce one product, in the afternoon they produce another product. In a faster changing economy, greater flexibility is necessary to adjust to rapidly changing conditions. Rapidly changing conditions, I think, are the future for the state of Oregon. And the more that you in leadership positions can help the state adjust rapidly to rapid change, I think the better off the people of the state will be. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Carnelly. We're going to leave plenty of time at the end for questions.
Thank you.
So before we get into the revenue update, Josh Lehner is going to give a little bit of a few comments about the recent performance of the Oregon economy and our outlook.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committees. Right now, for the July 2012, the unemployment rate in the state of Oregon is 8.7%. That's a little bit above the U.S. average at 8.3% in July. That's a quick typo right there. It's down a percentage point from a year ago, basically. It's been flat in the most recent months and actually increased a couple tenths of a percentage point in the most recent months, even though we're gaining jobs. Right now, we're in the middle of the pack in terms of job growth on a year-over-year basis. With the rising unemployment rate and continued employment gains, this sound like a little bit of mixed signals, but that has to do to some of the idiosyncratic natures of the two different surveys that the Employment Department and the Bureau of Labor Statistics uses to calculate the unemployment rate, which is a survey of households, and then the job growth, the payroll jobs, which is a survey of businesses. They're two different methodologies, two different samples. So even though they maybe differ a little bit on any given month, they're both pointing to slow, moderate growth here in Oregon, and we're seeing some continued improvements even in the most recent months. Right now, personal income growth is about 3% on a quarter-over-quarter basis or on a year-over-year basis. That's lower than what we've seen in the last couple expansions. We're looking for somewhere in the 4 to 6% range we'd like to see for personal income. Some of this has to do with wages and salaries are growing a little bit slower than we saw in past expansions. But our other measure of wages is our withholding we get out of tax collections, and those are being a little bit stronger than some of these measures we see in this particular data set. So it's encouraging. We think the upward revisions to this data set would be good, just along with the withholding we're seeing on a monthly basis out of payroll. Exports in the state, which have been a bright spot so far in the recovery, have now turned south in the most recent months. They're down 5% on a year-over-year basis. Our largest sector is down 11%. Agriculture is down 20%. That's our second largest sector, while everything else is up about 5%. And you can see on this next graph, the international slowdown that Mark had talked about and the manufacturing slowdown, it's certainly showing up in the Oregon data, particularly in our exports. This is sorted, so the red bars are the 2012 growth, sort of from the worst to the best across some of the major trading partners we have. China and Malaysia are our two most important, largest trading partners. They're nearly 30% of our exports in 2011, and so far they were down 20% in 2011 and nearly 30% so far in 2012, and a lot of that is our high-technology products. A little bit of grains, some wheat, but by and large, the vast majority are our high-tech products. The Eurozone, they're going through their recession at the moment. Our trading's down with them. Japan and South Korea are our fourth and fifth largest trading partners. They're basically flat combined. Japan's down a little bit. South Korea's up just due to some increased, actually, wheat exports, mostly to South Korea, propping up those exports. And you can see across some of these other trading partners, they're not a large percentage of our overall growth. North America is actually doing really well. Both Canada and Mexico's economies are outperforming most of the advanced economies in the world. So that trading growth is encouraging. But overall, our major trading partners are hurting or slowing down, just like we're seeing in some of the data. The next two graphs, we talked a lot about in the last year or two, about the two major drags on economic growth in this recovery, but being housing and government. They're slowing, you know, they're negative factors in terms of economic growth. But the good news is housing is no longer a drag. Mark talked about residential investment, new construction being up in more recent months, sort of offsetting some of the manufacturing weakness. Here in Oregon, we're adding about 200 jobs per month in housing-related industries. That's construction workers, mortgage brokers, real estate agents, home improvement stores, and the like. They tanked early in the recession, prior to the recession. They stayed negative even through the first year recovery. Overall, they lost about 31-32% of their employment during this business cycle, and they're just now beginning to come off the ground. So we find that encouraging that the housing market is showing signs of life and employment's growing. So this particular sector is a slight positive to economic growth here in the near term and moving forward. The other major drag in terms of employment growth has been the public sector. Overall, throughout this business cycle, you can see here, this sort of decomposes a lot of the public sector growth here in Oregon. State education is up considerably in the last 4 years. A lot of that has to do with the increased demand for colleges. You know, you have a lousy economy, more students want to go back and add skills and go to college. There's more tuition money, so you can hire more teachers or more professors. That's a little bit relatively straightforward. The state government non-education component increased the first few years of the recession, sort of the slow and steady growth you typically see out of government. You also had additional hirings to meet the needs of increased service demands from citizens, extra workers to process unemployment claims, to process Medicare and Medicaid claims, things like that. But that has trended downward in the last couple of years. And at this point in time, it's basically flat over the last 4 years. You can see it's plus 400 jobs, which is essentially where we were 4 years ago, 4.5 years ago. And then The local government, you can see that's basically flat as well over this time period. Where we've seen a lot of the cuts in government employment in the state of Oregon have been at the K-12 and community college level, the local education component. And the percentage basis, it's basically right now where the private sector on there for comparison. You can see private sector still down just under 100,000 jobs from where they were four and a half years ago. So even though that's mending slowly, improving at about a 1.5% growth increase in the last couple of years, it's still quite a long ways to go before they're back to where they were prior to the recession.
Thanks, Josh. So for the revenue outlook, obviously the revenues are not immune to this downgrade in the economic outlook. Well, you're pulling personal income, or at least wages and salaries, down by more than 2% in the out years. And of course, this relates to a similar decrease in the revenue outlook. So the overall revenue picture, of course, is not a good one with this still slow growth, but even less so than last time. However, in terms of the good news, for one, this, as we revise the economic forecast and put in weaker growth, it takes a while for this growth to fully manifest itself in revenues. And so far to date, we've been doing okay. Since we last came here in May, we've been pulling in about $25 million more than we expected at that time. So what the upshot of this is that for this current biennium, or fiscal year 2013, we're still in pretty good shape. In fact, we expect now a little bit more revenue than we did 3 months ago. However, over time, this slower growth forecast does more and more damage to the state budget. In recent months, we've seen personal income tax collections come back after a weak April. April, we got hit by a big surge in refunds, which we expected at that time. But since then, we've seen gains, very similar to what Josh described in the private economy, with income growing at roughly two-thirds of its typical rate during an expansion. This is what we're seeing with our tax revenues. We're growing at about two-thirds what we would a typical recovery in Oregon. But the encouraging part about the personal income taxes is we are getting support here from both the labor forms of taxable income and your non-labor investment forms of income. We're seeing a little bit growth with everything, and somewhat faster than we expected. Also, the corporate excise tax collections have been doing a little bit better than we expected, quite a bit better. In fact, July was the first month that we saw year-over-year gains in 11 months. They weren't big, but corporate income tax collections were up. We're going to watch this closely going forward because there's a lot of uncertainty in this outlook. Profits are very volatile, and the corporate taxes that result from those profits are even more so. What we have right now, the flavor of the outlook going forward, is we have one more year of losses in these corporate tax collections. Profitability still seems atypically high from a historical perspective. We have, and so too do these corporate income tax collections relative to our size of overall output or our size of overall profits. So we have this coming down throughout fiscal year 2013, followed by a very strong growth in the 13-15 biennium, in keeping with the historic volatility of this series. We're only roughly half the growth we've seen in other profit booms. The most recent profit booms, we've seen quite a bit of growth. We're being more conservative than that, but nevertheless, we expect after this long dry spell to get a surge in revenue at some point. But the timing is everything. So as this right now, the timing has this growth coming in 13-15, but that is subject to change. So at the top line for the current biennium, we have increased the forecast considerably by just under $100 million for the September forecast, putting us right about where we were when the governor recommended his budget in December of 2010. Now, a lot of that has to do with legislative actions in both the May session and the new February session.
But for the most part, we've seen the outlook for 2011-13 stabilize. And going forward, through the rest of the tax year, things look like we should be on fairly stable footing. The biggest risk for this year would be a stock market correction before the end of the calendar year, before December 31st. That could significantly hit our revenues in this biennium. But if not for that, we have a relatively slow growth in wages built in here. We have a very conservative expectations for this fall's extended filers of personal income tax returns, people who requested extensions. Those come in October. Last year they were disappointing, and we're going to expect the same sort of thing this year. And so the issues really come as we head in deeper into the forecast. And this is when this 2% downgrade in the income forecast really starts to impact our revenues. As you see here, the overall forecast for general fund revenues plus lottery transfers is down over $300 million in 2013-15 and another $100 million almost every year following. Now, as a share of the economy, that's the same. The increases there are just due to compounding over time as everything grows, as income and population and whatnot grow, so too do these revisions. One note to make is the lottery forecast. The lottery forecast is down significantly. You see here in 2013-15 and 2015-17, nearly $100 million a year. Some of that, around $20 million or so, has to do with our expectation of a weaker economy and weaker sales of everything, weaker consumer spending on everything, including the video lottery. But some of it has to do with technical changes relating to the transfer rate. The lottery will be transferring less money over a five-year period to the general fund in order to refresh their video terminals, to put investment back into their video terminals. And this pulls down the lottery forecast in the near term. So when we stand back, it's clear that agencies that are dependent on lottery have had a particularly rough go of it in this recession. We see that lottery now, after these transfers, lottery revenues are as bad as they were in the depths of the recession. We haven't improved at all, whereas more broadly, general funds are now back to their pre-recession peaks, even though, of course, the need and cost of government services have increased significantly. So overall, I'm not going to go through each one of the detailed charts that I always show, but as you see, the overall flavor of the forecast has not changed. This is personal income taxes, blue line being the new forecast, red line being the old, and we have just changed the slope here a little bit. We're growing a little bit slower, and same with corporate income taxes, but the flavor of the forecast still remains pretty much the same from the last couple of rounds. One note on this forecast summary slide, I typically include in that information about reserve balances. I forgot to write the reserves at the end. Here we see, in addition to this, where we see what I've spoken about in terms of the general fund forecast, where personal income taxes and corporate income taxes are up. In terms of all other revenues, most other revenue categories are higher as well. We got significant increases in over expectations, that is, in estate taxes and in liquor apportionment and also in court and judicial related fees. There's also good news in terms of administrative actions. At these very low interest rates, the state is able to refinance its debt at very favorable rates, and so we're gaining another $9.7 million in interest savings. And then, of course, we're taking away 17 from the lottery, which I typically write at the bottom of this sheet, and I did not. So in terms of the upshot, that leaves us with an ending balance of $193 million expected at the end of this fiscal year, $137 of which will be transferred as the 1% transfer to the rainy day fund, leaving a $56 million balance expected at the end of the biennium if all goes well. For the long-term forecast, the story is the same.
You see here, we're really stuck at this 11% rate for the next two or three biennium. And then as we get into the out years, growth is even slower due to the aging of the population. So we're looking at 10 or 11% growth per biennium. As we can compare this with our recent expansions, we were looking at 15 or 20% growth a biennium. So this is considerably slower than we've become accustomed to, and likely also slower than the costs and caseloads of government services are going to go up over this time. So with that, I want to thank you for your time and would be welcome to open up for any questions.
Thank you, gentlemen. Committee members.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question would maybe be directed to Dr. Connolly. What kind of response has the business community and investors, what kind of response are they making today in light of the pending tax cliff? And what effect does that have on current tax revenues that may be a bubble rather than sustainable?
Yeah. Senator Morrison, members of the committee, there's a short answer and a long answer. The short answer is I don't know. but the long answer comes to the same conclusion with a lot of elaboration. The business leaders I talk to are very worried about the fiscal cliff. They're worried about a variety of policy issues, the fiscal cliff, uncertainty about health care costs. The financial service folks are very worried about what Dodd-Frank is going to mean when it's fully implemented. But and I think that is depressing some current activity, some current spending, but I think that's probably minor compared to the depressed effects on activity just from lack of confidence in future sales. And I think that if Congress were to sort of announce today that they had figured out how to deal with the fiscal cliff and remove all uncertainty about that, I think businesses would still be cautious on account of they're not at all convinced that their sales are going to be stronger in 2013 than 2012. Does that address the question you're asking?
That's helpful, but I was thinking more in terms of a taxpayer's response to the potential of a major tax increase and what actions they're taking today that will mitigate or move those income streams into this fiscal year as opposed to waiting and seeing and gambling. And does that create essentially an artificial bubble in tax receipts?
Senator Morris, in terms of our baseline forecast, what we're expecting, the biggest place this plays is in capital gains. And in terms of our baseline forecast, we're going with our national vendors' assumption that taxes on high-income folks will be increased going forward in the federal level. And for capital gains, that some of these Bush-era tax cuts for the highest end will be allowed to expire. And what that does is it causes folks to pull forward some of these gains into the current tax year. And when we consult with tax lawyers and our accountants, they tell us that this is certainly the advice that they're giving their clients, although they haven't seen much of it yet because people don't pay their taxes this early in the year. But this is certainly the advice that they are giving. And so, as we've seen in the past, in particular in the Reagan era, in the mid-80s, there was a huge shift due to an impending tax change. And we have this built into the model based on those historical examples. We do have some pull forward into this year, causing a pretty big April. But that said, this is highly uncertain, not only because, it's hard to predict the federal policy, but also, how this is going to play out and how Oregon taxpayers are going to respond is somewhat of an open question.
Thank you.
That's your question. Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my question also is for Dr. Connolly, and I guess if the business of government is to create expectations, which I think it is, ones that people can rely upon, what area of government would you suggest we make more flexible?
Representative Benson, members of the committee, government is big, and I don't know that I did not come here with an agenda for you. But I would suggest in all of the activities the question be raised, especially with new programs but also with existing ones, is there a way to make the plan incremental? For instance, one might imagine saying, hey, here is our core budget, and it doesn't spend every dollar we have available for us, but we've got another set of expenditures that we will make starting halfway through the biennium or a fourth of the way through the biennium. And if it looks like we're doing okay, then we do the additional things. And that requires a prioritization, which is difficult, even harder than forming a budget, is prioritizing the items within it. But that's exactly the sort of thing that should be done, and it probably should be done within the various functions of government as well as the big picture of the overall budget.
Thank you. The future, then, is uncertain, and your thought is that we take that into account by shortening the time frame within which our decisions impact our state. But it seems to me that this flies in the face of those who argue we should be doing things that are foundationally reliable and things that people can rely upon. And I understand your thought. It means we should maybe have a larger savings account. It means that we should be more careful in how we spend our money and more short-term in our decisions. But it's going to be difficult to put those two competing concepts together.
Representative Vince, I think you're exactly right. But there are some things that the state does that the timing has some flexibility. So we want the state to maintain, not just maintain roads, but upgrade some roads, upgrade some bridges. There's some flexibility on when we do that. And those are the kinds of projects that might be sort of put on hold until we learn the budget situation.
Thank you.
Further questions? Could I take the time to just pursue what you just said just a moment further? That works pretty well if you're doing roads. It doesn't work so well when you're doing prisons and schools. So what you're suggesting from a business point of view works better, wouldn't you say, than a government point of view?
Representative Berger, yes. There are some businesses, though, that are in the same kind of service situation. So it's not strictly a business government. It's a matter of what your functions are. And many functions don't work very well going up and down in value. But the fact of the matter is we have voted for a tax structure that produces a highly variable revenue stream. And the challenge is how do you live with a highly variable revenue stream and a desire for a stable service stream. And one way is to make the activities more variable. The other way is to actually accumulate a large rainy day fund in the good times and spend it down in the bad times, although there are always folks who believe it's constantly raining in Oregon, which makes saving for a rainy day a challenge.
Mr. Connery, Dr. Connerly, I don't think you could have put that better, and Senator Morris and Senator Burdick are very pleased with that response, as I think all of us are. This committee has grappled with that repeatedly, and it is well stated. Are there further questions?
Yeah, Madam Chair.
You couldn't stand it.
Actually, I do appreciate your comments. My question is focused more on the long-term picture and looking at the national options that exist. What do we have left, you know, in the bag of tricks to jolt this economy and get it back moving? ARRA didn't seem to work very well. We have, you know, overhanging debt that's growing at rates that are unsustainable, and we have increased taxes that will dampen the economic activity. I mean, what's left in this bag of tricks that will move this thing forward?
You want me to keep
that's
rolling?
A tricky one.
Senator Morse, our economy wants to grow. People, believe it or not, want to get up in the morning and go to work. A lot of entrepreneurs want to develop new products, new services, new ways of delivering old products and services. So there is growth kind of built in, and the challenge is we sometimes stumble, and either through external events or through our own policy put in impediments to that growth. But I have benefited by having, in years of forecasting, having in my head that the economy wants to grow, and we just either need to let it go or remove some impediments. I share all of your concerns about the economy. I'm expecting higher taxes, but we also have a great deal of creativity. On the policy side, I think we'll probably get another round of quantitative easing, and that will provide some limited stimulus 4 quarters later, temporary stimulus. When Europe works through its problems and China adjusts to its efforts to reduce inflation, the external environment becomes stronger, and then the inherent desire of this economy to expand will probably prop us up a little bit. But I've looked hard to find hints of a boom in the economic numbers. I don't find any hints of a boom, but I do find, I think, reasonable basis for moderate economic growth.
Thank you.
Representative Benz.
Thank you for your indulgence, Madam Chair. I would like to follow this discussion, but I'm not going to. The question that I would like to address to our economist is this. We enjoy either the second or third highest income tax in the nation, and if the Bush tax cuts end, this will make Oregon even less attractive to those who earn lots of money because their income taxes at the federal level will increase. Does your prognostication suggest that there will be more people not willing to come to Oregon as a result of this stacking on, this 10% tax on top of the much higher federal rates, or have you thought that really it won't make any difference at all? Vis-a-vis other states is really...
Oh, Representative Benz, so you're talking about the unwinding of Measure 66, not the federal increase, because the federal increase, of course, impacts everyone.
Right. Madam Chair.
Yes.
Yeah, the question is this. We enjoy the third or fourth highest tax rate in the nation, income tax rate. So my question is, does the ending of the Bush tax cuts affect Oregon more than maybe, let's say, a Washington or an Idaho that enjoys lower income tax rates? That's the question. Of course, it would affect everyone at the federal level equally. The question is, does it affect Oregon more because of our tax structure?
Yes, Representative, that is possible. Our concern in our office is it has to do with aging Oregonians who, in particular, have a lot of assets, capital gains, businesses to sell. Over time, you know, there has been a historic flow of folks from the south and northeast into Oregon and then up into Washington and whatnot, and a lot of this does have to, or some of this does have to do with tax incentives. Our concern is you know, does this dynamic increase significantly when we have this big surge in retirees? Do we see more? And obviously the timing of, you know, increasing this tax burden is problematic. And many people believe that this, that, you know, when it comes to making the decision to sell your estate, that it certainly plays a factor, the variable tax rate, but it's not, of course, the only factor, and that's why most folks end up selling in Oregon and not doing this jumping ship. But as we increase that share of taxes, you know, there is some danger that, you know, more people will choose to go that route.
Thank you.
Further question for these gentlemen? Mr. Co-Chair, nothing? Okay. Thank you very much. A little mixed bag, some immediate good news followed by some not so good news going forward, I would say. Thank you.
Members of the committee, we're a little ahead of schedule. Is there any chance we could start up again at
9:30?
I think we will go into recess until 9:30, and then we'll start up again.
Back into session here for this committee. The next thing on our agenda is to have a some words and discussion with Mr. Jim Buchholz, who is,
Buchholz.
I'm sorry. It's a tricky pronunciation. Jim is the new director of the Department of Revenue, and we have noted there have been some recent issues that we'd like to have him come in and discuss with us. Welcome, Jim Buchholz. I will get it right. And we appreciate you coming in this morning.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jim Buchholz, Director of the Department of Revenue. With your permission, I think what I'll do is I'll start with some background about the incident and do a brief recap of the investigations and maybe talk about some of the changes that we've made at the Department of Revenue since finding out about the incident. And then I'll answer two specific questions that I know that you're wanting to hear. One will go to the appropriateness of the discipline, and the other to speak to whether or not taxpayers can have confidence that the system at the Department of Revenue is working. So, to the background, in mid-May this year, we learned that we had mistakenly issued a fraudulent $2.1 million refund. And after learning of the incident, we conducted several different investigations. We did an HR investigation to find out how it happened, the background for that. We called Department of Justice in to do an investigation to find out if there was any collusion or criminal behavior within the Department of Revenue that helped this to happen or that caused this to happen. We did a technical audit investigation as well, where we had one of our auditors go back and look at all of the refunds that we've issued over the past 3 years, all of the large refunds that we've issued over the past 3 years, to see if there were any other large incidents that slipped through. And then lastly, we did an internal audit investigation to find out if the proper controls were in place and whether or not there was anything else that we could do that would shore up the process to ensure that this didn't happen again. So let me speak to the results of the investigations. The DOJ investigation, Department of Justice investigation, they found no collusion within the Department of Revenue or criminal activity within the department. And DOJ did pursue criminal action against the perpetrator. And I think that's been in the papers, so everybody knows about that. We did a technical audit investigation. The results of that were where we reviewed all of those large refunds over the past 3 years, and there were no other fraudulent refunds allowed. And the threshold that we used was $50,000. We went down to that level. As you might imagine, that's quite a few refunds. There are several hundred or several thousand refunds that we've issued over the past 3 years that are over $50,000, but we determined that all of them were appropriate. We did an HR investigation, a human resources investigation, and the result of that, in a nutshell, is that the system did its job and it kicked out the return for manual review, but the manual reviews weren't completed properly in this instance. There were incorrect assumptions about work that others were doing, and there were errors in judgment, and so that was the HR investigation. And then the internal audit investigation. The internal auditors determined that the electronic system controls were proper, and that the manual system controls were adequate as well, but they weren't followed. And so that's what the internal audit found. They made several different recommendations to us for how we might be able to strengthen the controls. And I won't speak on the record as to what controls we have in place, because I don't want to speak about what we're doing because I don't want to give good people bad ideas. But
bad people.
If I may, that's a very kind way of saying it.
But we have taken steps to provide additional security to make sure it won't happen again. So we're in the process of implementing or have implemented several things. First, improving documentation on desk procedures for our suspense workers. This is the first line of defense that we have for these types of returns. There were desk procedures, but they weren't adequate, and so we're taking a look at those, and we're doing what we can to enhance those to make sure that they do the job better in the future. We're providing enhanced reviewer training for the manager doing review, and that was one of the suggestions, was to provide the enhanced reviewer training. What we've actually done is we've embedded an auditor into the area to do the more technical reviews. There are certain reviews that the manager of that particular area can do and do well, just as efficiently as anybody else. But there are others, and the internal auditor noted that some of the reviews that we were asking of the manager were more technical, and either we needed to give her more training or do something different to make sure that somebody else was doing those reviews to make sure that they had the skills that were doing it. So what we've done is we've embedded an auditor to make sure that the auditor is looking at it. And I'll be honest, one of the things that's been the most embarrassing to me about this whole incident is that recognition that we have at the Department of Revenue more people who are trained in the ability to spot these types of issues than probably anybody else in state government, but we weren't using them. We have auditors and people that are trained to be able to detect issues that are incorrect in taxpayers' returns, but we had them doing other things other than the review of these returns, and so we've got an auditor now that's doing the more technical reviews. We also, the internal auditor noted a flaw in the high-level review process and that some reviews weren't being routed to the proper person. And so we've corrected that. We've changed the process now to make sure that the highest level reviews, and the highest level reviews I mean for dollar amounts, a certain threshold, are all going to an administrator, the administrator of the Personal Income Tax Division. And she's an ex-auditor. She's trained in the ability to do this. And so we believe that's more appropriate. We've also automated a review process that was being done by paper. I don't think we realized, to be honest, that we still had pieces of this review process that was still paper. At least I didn't realize it. And so we've automated that to make sure that it's done electronically, because it's more efficient and more accurate to be able to do it electronically other than paper. And then lastly, we're going to be using data to refine our business rules to ensure that staff are spending time on the highest ROI work. One of the things that the internal auditor found was that some of the business rules that we have in the system that kick out returns for manual review, we're kicking out a lot of returns for manual review, but very few. I mean, like on the order, I think it was 0.2% were being adjusted. And so that was flooding the unit with work that wasn't particularly productive. And so anytime you do that, then it makes less time for the things that are productive. And so what we're going to do is we're going to be taking a look at those business rules to make sure that it's kicking out the returns that have the highest probability of there being a particular issue or creating the highest return on investment for the staff time. And I would say, too, before I move to the discipline question, or I move to questions from you first, one other lesson that I learned in the wake of this mistake and that we will be taking steps to correct is that in looking at our operation, in particular the processing center part of our operation, it's pretty clear that we've been emphasizing efficiency over effectiveness. And what I mean by that is that our processing center performance measures go to timeliness and reducing cost. And it's clear, obviously, that we need to do a better job of emphasizing accuracy in the process. And there's an old adage that
what gets measured gets worked on, and that's absolutely been true for us here in the processing center. We've been working hard on the timeliness issues. We've been working hard on reducing costs to process, but we need to do a better job of emphasizing accuracy as well. So that's what we're going to be doing, implementing or identifying performance measures that can achieve that right balance between efficiency and accuracy. And so I'll stop here before I move on to the next question and ask if you've got any questions of me.
I think we'll wait until you're completely done, and then we'll...
Okay. The first question that I know that you've got goes to the level of discipline for the staff and whether or not that was appropriate. In disciplinary actions, there's a full range of options that are possible, from doing nothing to termination. And where you land on that continuum has to be legally defensible. The collective bargaining agreement and labor law establishes the upper bounds of discipline for employees, or what constitutes appropriate discipline for employees. In our incident, there was no criminal activity that was found. And under law, the upper bounds of discipline are established not by the magnitude of the error, but on the actions and intent of the employees. And so, for me personally, I knew that severe discipline wouldn't, or excuse me, a lack of severe discipline wouldn't play well in the court of public opinion. DOR had obviously taken, Department of Revenue had obviously taken a huge hit in public trust, and I knew that harsh discipline would temporarily buy back some of that trust. And to be honest, early on in the process, that's where I thought we were headed. I really did think that we were headed for termination on this. But before taking action, we consulted closely with our labor relations attorneys. And they confirmed for us that the upper bounds of discipline didn't support termination in this instance. We were told that if we went there, we risked certain reversal by the Employment Relations Board. It takes a long time to get through the appeal process. Obviously, if you do any discipline, there is appeal. There are appeal rights for the employees. It takes a long time to get through that process. It's costly. And to be honest, the Employment Relations Board has a history of restoring people to their jobs when it's all said and done. So it would have cost the state more money to defend the actions, and at the end of the day, I think it would have compounded the problem with public trust, because they would have been restored to their jobs, and we would have been right back where we started from. And so ultimately I made the decision to do what was legally defensible and limit further financial loss to the state. The other question that you had that I know you've got goes to whether or not taxpayers can have confidence that the system is working. And the most honest answer that I can give you is that taxpayers have both reason for confidence and reason for concern. And so I'll get into both of those. The reason for confidence: the system that we have in place is based on industry best practices. Across the nation, all of the states that have an income tax and the IRS, for the vast majority of them, with maybe one exception, which I'll talk about a little bit later, they identify common fraud characteristics within the system and kick them out for manual review. So best practice across the nation includes that element of manual review that we've got. We've got those business rules that are built into the system to kick out those returns, and we're continually adding new business rules as we learn more about fraud and the things that are happening out there. We partner with other states through the Federation of Tax Administration, or excuse me, Federation of Tax Administrators. This is an organization, a national organization, that gets states together to talk about issues of common concern. And we do partner with the FTA. In fact, we share best practices with each other. At the recent FTA conference, it was an FTA technology conference, I think, 2 weeks ago, and we sent some people back to that.
Georgia shared an idea that they had implemented in the last year. It's a promising new vendor relationship that we're going to be looking into. It was very productive for Georgia in identifying fraud and stopping it. Now, I don't know the extent to which that will help Oregon, because I don't know the baseline that Georgia was starting from, whether or not they were doing less than we were or more than we were, so I'd be reticent to say exactly what I thought this might provide for Oregon, but we'll definitely be looking into it because it looks like something that would be very productive for us. At Department of Revenue, we have a team of 22 people that is, that, as I said, the first line of defense for these types of issues, for reviewing the returns that are flagged by the system. The team works fraud business rules, and it works other business rules as well. We've so far this year have caught about $2.3 million in fraud attempts where we've intercepted them and stopped them from going out. And the year's still going, so the number for this particular year isn't established yet for what else they find, but in last year the team found $37 million in other net adjustments from returns that had been kicked out for the manual review. So the team that's in place there really is very productive and does their jobs well. I gave you a handout. You should have a handout that looks like this. Yes. This identifies the fraud that we've caught over the past few years, from 2009 through 2012. And there's a couple things that I wanted to point out on this. First, there was a question about, okay, we've been looking at, because the paper reported that we'd looked at the returns over 50,000 and that there was a particular edit in the system or a business rule in the system that kicked out returns over 50,000 for a special review. As to whether or not there were hundreds or thousands of small fraud returns, hundreds or thousands of $2,000 returns that we're getting through. And what I wanted to point out on this is that the business rules within the system for fraud are blind to dollar amount. That $50,000 rule has nothing to do with fraud. That's just a general rule that we've got for all of the returns that we look at. All of the business rules that we have that identify the fraud or potential fraud attempts are blind to dollar amounts. And so we have several that you can see that the vast majority of the attempts are under $1,000, and that's what we've got. So that was one of the things I wanted to point out. The other thing that I wanted to point out is the trend over time, and that's that it's growing. And I don't know whether, to be honest, the trend is growing because there are more attempts or whether it's because we're getting better at detecting it. I suspect it's a little bit of both, but the trend is definitely increasing over time. So that's what I'd say it would be the reasons the taxpayer would have confidence in Department of Revenue. The reasons for concern are just that this is a huge problem for all states that have an income tax and the IRS. And it's growing. And there isn't one fix, I think, that will make this go away. I think you might look at it similar to computer viruses or hackers. The people out there that want to do bad things are continually finding new ways to do bad things, and the states and the IRS have to continually try to stay on top of them in order to stop them. So there isn't one fix that'll make it go away. To illustrate how big an issue this is for the states, at that recent FTA conference that I spoke about, the single most attended session, the most well-attended session, was the session on fraud, the session where Georgia had introduced or reported on this vendor relationship that they had. The technology conference, the FDA technology conference, has several different things that are of interest to the states, to the state revenue departments. But that one single thing that was of most interest to all the states was the session on fraud. So it's not just a problem for Oregon. It's a problem that all states are wrestling with. Can more be done? I think most certainly that there are opportunities for us. I mentioned the thing that Georgia had found. We know that Idaho had recently instituted a business rule within their system to match the employer ID number on the W-2 to their employment department database. And this last year, I think, was the first year that they've done it, that they did it. And my understanding that the results of that were that it kicked out 48,000 returns for review. And of those 48,000, they found 100 were fraudulent. And so, in fact, Idaho has a statute where they have to pay interest on their returns if the processing goes beyond 60 days. And they had to turn off this particular business rule in the middle of the season because it was overwhelming them. And they turned it back on. But to be honest, I don't think that's something that's going to be particularly productive for Oregon, because presumably several of those 100 we would have caught with our other business rules. And the reason why there are so many that are kicked out for this is because the employer ID number is something that's manually entered for electronically filed returns. And so there's transposition errors, I'm sure, and other issues that cause problems. But the one, I think, opportunity for us if we want to go much deeper into this is what New York is doing. We learned in the last month that New York is probably the only state that does real-time W-2 matching. And by real time, I mean as the return is being processed, the withholding that is claimed by the taxpayer or the prepayments that are claimed by the taxpayer are pinged against a database. They're pinged against the employment database for New York. And what they've done that's different than the other states is they've attached additional information that's required from employers on the unemployment form. And that additional information is the wages and the federal wages, because right now all the employment form captures is the wages that are subject to unemployment. And it also they require them to list and report the withholding information. And so New York, what they'll do when they process these returns are due on January 31st, the employment returns with this information, and the system is up and running for them, they say, by mid-February, and they do a real-time match of that W-2 information in order to, and it's been very successful for them. But I would say that there are a couple of policy choices that have to be made if that's where we want to go for Oregon. One of the things that makes this effective for Oregon, or excuse me, for New York, is that they have penalties for noncompliance, and the penalties are fairly severe. I think it's $200 per information return or per W-2 that the employer has to report if it's either late or incorrect. Obviously, it's really key that we have that information, or that the states have that information as soon as possible, so that they can start processing, and it has to be accurate. And so they do fine the employers for noncompliance. And then the second thing that I think is an important policy choice, we would have to accept that refunds would be delayed. New York estimates that this particular part of their process where they do the real-time W-2 matching delays the refunds by about 30 days. And so right now in our process, I think it's about 5 to 10 days where we turn our refunds around and we get some complaints. that 5 to 10 days is too long. And so what we would need is we would need legislative backing, I think, that the refunds would be delayed in order to do this. Let me just wrap up, if I can, before the questions and say this. This mistake is both frustrating and embarrassing for us. But I would say, in spite of the mistake, I have faith that our staff is doing about as well as anybody in the country in this regard to fighting fraud. Now, that sounds funny, I think, in wake of this particular mistake. I get that. But I do have confidence in our staff that we're doing well in this. We are continually on the look for ways to get better at what we do. I would say that it's fair to say that all of the Department of Revenue is embarrassed by this. We recognize, too, that it doesn't just impact DOR, but it impacts how Oregonians feel about all of their government. And we bear that responsibility in the... we bear the responsibility for having brought that on Oregon. So I apologize on the record on behalf of Department of Revenue to all Oregonians for our mistake. But please know that we do take our stewardship role in this seriously.
Thank you, Mr. Pujols. I can assure you that this committee values the Department of Revenue of more than... probably any other committee in the legislature. We use the services of your folks to do our policy, and it is of critical importance that, as what I believe is the most important state agency out there in them all, from where I sit in here, that as you say, there's been some confidence shaken over this particular incident. That being said, I'm going to open this to questions and take them in the order I see them. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for coming today to share information about this incident, and I agree that it was embarrassing. I think that it also sheds light on how important those workers are in the Department of Revenue. That is such a core function of our state government, and I want to thank the people that do that work every day. But I have to say my confidence was further shaken because, and you and I have talked about this incident, Mr. Ross and I have talked about this incident, and I would thank Mr. Ross, who's been extremely helpful. But at the same time this was going on, I was helping a constituent that was having trouble on the opposite end. He was an honest, upstanding taxpayer that was having a very difficult time communicating with the Department of Revenue. And some of the problems that happened there seemed to be very similar to the oversights and operational practices that led to the incident that's getting all of the attention. So just for the sake of the committee, I wanted to highlight this and explain that my concern is less with the individual workers and more with the management structure and the expectation of the way that things are run, beginning in the mailroom and all the way to the back end. So this particular taxpayer was retired. He's been filing taxes in Oregon for decades. And in this year, he got a letter asking for his 1099 forms, which he had never been asked for before. He was concerned that it might be an audit, that he might have a problem. He was concerned about confidentiality. So he called the Department of Revenue just to ask why he needed to send the information. When his first interaction with the agency was an operator that said that they were very busy and that they didn't answer those kinds of questions, he asked if there was an ombudsman, and he was told no, that he should just write a letter directly to you. This was a concern for him because he was sure that you had other things to do besides respond to his question about this request for documentation. But he responded to that. He sent the letter within 48 hours of receiving this letter from the Department of Revenue. And then he waited and heard nothing. And that's when he contacted my office. When I contacted the Department of Revenue, the letter had been received, and apparently it had not been read. Because in the letter he said, I don't have a W-4 or W-2 because I'm retired, but I do have the 1099s. I'm happy to send them. Could someone just explain to me why? Whoever received that letter took that to mean that he did not have the 1099s, so she adjusted his bill, or adjusted his account, disallowed his deductions, and he went from having a $900-some refund owed to him to owing the Department of Revenue $33. And he was receiving a bill that said he had to pay this by May 10th or else he would be subject to interest. So I asked how he could resolve this. He was now very motivated to send in these 1099s. And Mr. Ross was very helpful and said, have him send them directly to me. I will hand deliver them to whoever needs to do this. And that was on April 25th. This guy mailed them that day. This taxpayer was so on top of it and so friendly. That was the other thing. This was one of those guys that didn't
get mad. We need to hurry this story. Okay.
So he sends it in, and we wait and we wait and we wait. And on May 11th, he still hasn't heard anything. I contacted Mr. Ross. Mr. Ross still hasn't received it, even though it was sent to his attention, and Mr. Ross explained that the department still...
Is there a question in this?
There is. It was still not opening mail that had been received as of April 21st. And so my concern is, how can anyone catch anything if the mail isn't opened, it doesn't go to who it needs to go to, if taxpayers can't answer questions, and this guy would still be out $900 because he asked a question if a legislator hadn't intervened? That's not the way the Department of Revenue should work, and it plays out both in fraud and in retired people being sunk for $900.
No.
Jim, I know you can't speak to the specific taxpayer, but I think the question is, it isn't just the suspense
right.
unit that people are having problems with.
Right. Madam Chair, Representative Gelser, again, I apologize. That isn't the way that we do business normally. I mentioned to you when we met earlier that we process about 5 million pieces of paper a year, and most of them we do it flawlessly, but we do make mistakes, and in most of the mistakes that we make, we catch on the first notice that we've got a problem. Occasionally, some work through the system, and wind up with an even more embarrassing thing like what you've got here. Department of Revenue, I think it's fair to say, is undergoing the most significant culture change that we've been through in at least the 30 years that I've been there at the Department of Revenue. We are doing significant reworking of our processes and our procedures. Many of these go to readiness for the new system, for when we get approval for the new system, but most of them really just go to trying to be more efficient and more effective. The types of things that we're doing in the department are on an order of magnitude greater than most of the fixes in we've always had improvements or tried to do improvements to our system through the years, but what we're trying to do now is much more. And I think we've made some mistakes in the regard. There's been fits and starts in changing the processes that have caused more issues to fall through the cracks, like maybe your constituent. I think that our leadership team has acknowledged that we probably didn't prioritize change leadership in the department like we ought to have, that we treated it much like we've treated many of the other process and procedure changes that we've made in the past, and not recognizing that what we're trying to do is on a much larger scale, and we needed to help the people that were making the changes to accept the changes. And I also think that we haven't done as good a job at prioritizing work within the department. And so much of the problems that we've seen are because of these wholesale changes that we're making. In the past, I think what we've done is when we've made a change to a process or done something different, we've told people, do this too, do this in addition to the other work, instead of do this instead, and helping them to prioritize their work, understanding. And most of the time you can get away with that because you're continually getting better and more efficient at what you're doing, and you're increasing the capacity to do different things. But I think that there wasn't a recognition that the things that we were trying to do at the department were on a scale that were greater than the things that we were doing in the past. And so we needed to allow people that freedom to prioritize the work and say, you're going to do this and not do this, that we were overwhelming them with additional work. And so I think it's that we recognize that and we're working on it. But I apologize to your constituent for the issue that they've got. And I know that Senator Burdick has also talked to me about an issue that she's had personally. And I apologize to you personally for it.
I wasn't going to say anything about
Senator Haas.
I was wondering if you could elaborate on your statements about discipline. This was a $2 million mistake. It wasn't a sophisticated computer hacking situation. It wasn't a virus. And when you say that, you know, we probably couldn't go further, this would be appealed, so there wasn't much we could do, that just doesn't sound right to me. I don't think it sounds right to Oregonians. And I'm just wondering if you could elaborate on that, why senior management didn't take some responsibility, including yourself.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Haas, I don't want to appear less than transparent, but I also don't want to. I can't get into the specific pieces of the incident that were the attitude that went to the attitude and intent of the employees, because that's something that's protected, and the AG has had an order that protects it. I will say that for the first person that looked at it, it was an unintentional mistake that it wasn't looked at. The second person that looked at it made an incorrect assumption about work that others were doing and made a decision that she didn't have the authority to make. And so that was where the discipline came for her. And the third and the fourth people that were involved made errors in judgment. They had the authority to make the decisions that they made, but they made errors in judgment in the decision that they made. And we worked with our labor relations attorneys to find out, because this isn't something that we do. I mean, our HR shop does it as part of their normal course of business, but something that rises to my level is not something that happens every day. And so I needed the advice and counsel of attorneys on this to know what was appropriate given the circumstance, and that's what they told. To be honest, I think that intentional negligence on a small refund would have warranted harsher discipline than unintentional mistakes on a large refund. So I get that this is a huge deal because of the magnitude of the error. I get that. But the magnitude of the error, the size of the refund, apparently isn't what drives the disciplinary process for employees. And so at the end of the day, we went with what we were told was legally defensible.
Is that responsive to your question, Senator?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment. I think that the trust was shaken twice in this, once with the incident and again with there being no real measurable consequences, because taxpayers know that they have consequences when they make mistakes on their tax returns.
Yes.
We hear all the time.
I agree.
Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, it's difficult not to pile on this deal. But it seems to me, if I have this right, you're precluded from taking action that maybe you as a manager would have liked to have taken by virtue of the contract. that protects employees from maybe knee-jerk reactions and maybe too hasty a reaction. I think I heard you say that your conversation with the labor lawyer as you went through the carefully parsed labor contract suggested you were limited in your response. Now, I'm going to set that aside, and I want to go to what you did, what you're allowed to do, and this is what it sounded to me like. It sounded like you hired an auditor to make sure these people did their job, and out in my part of the world, we call that two people on the same horse. And so that seems like an odd way to respond to a mistake made in your department. Now, I could be wrong. That auditor may be doing far more than just making sure people are doing what they should have been doing to begin with, but that's what I heard. The other thing that is irksome is that your other suggestion is that we go to, I think, a more expensive, I'm going to guess, computerized system which would allow us to real-time match W-2s. And that may be a really good idea. And that seems to be a movement that we discussed a year or so ago here as we talked about the accelerating pace of computerization in your department. And my question then was, okay, how many fewer people do we have as a result of that? And the answer was none. And the answer there, I think, was based upon the fact that you are overworked and understaffed. And if that's the case, you need to tell us. You need to say, hey, you've got too few people trying to do too much work. I haven't heard that so far. If that's the case, tell us. This is a pretty dang important department. Now, the lesson I'm drawing from this is we need some attention on the contracts you're entering into with your employees. Because just like Senator Haas, if somebody makes a mistake in my office, in my law office, it doesn't matter how small it is. We get sued. We are accountable. And that has to be what your department is also. Because our folks will not expect any less of us unless we demand it of you. So it's not going to be enough to sit here and say you're sorry, although I appreciate it. Okay. I know I apologize for piling on. But this is not going over well, Clover, in the distant reaches of this state. So answer any way you like. I hope to hear productive answers, not apologies, which at this point we've heard.
Madam Chair, Representative Bentz, fair enough. I mean, fair enough. Speaking to the first comment that you made that I couldn't go further, let me be clear that I could have gone further. I could have not taken the advice of the attorneys, and I could have terminated the employees. In my mind, I didn't think that would serve Oregonians because of the advice that we had gotten from the attorneys is that it would have been overturned on appeal. And it would have cost additional money and additional time, and it would have further eroded trust. I thought that at this point, the most prudent thing to do would be to stop the bleed, or to do whatever it took to end it right now and do what was appropriate under the law. Now, so I don't want to say that we couldn't have done it, or that I couldn't have made the decision to terminate. I could have. I just didn't think that was the right thing to do, because it would have been overturned. Secondly, the issue about two people on the same horse, the auditor in suspense. The auditor is taking that's part of the review function. So we have several levels of reviewing work. There's a model in risk management that it's most often used in the medical profession where something that relies on manual processes where something really egregious can happen in the medical profession. It's somebody giving the wrong type of medicine to somebody and causing a death, and the model pictures different filters that are stacked against each other. But because there are manual processes and it's something manual that you're relying on, the filters, each of the filters has holes in it. Manual processes are never perfect. They're always going to have holes in it. And the model recognizes that every so often when you're relying on manual processes, those holes line up. That the idea is for for the holes to, for you to make the holes as small as possible and as few as possible, but every so often the holes line up. And what you have to do then is add additional filters and add those redundancies to make sure that it minimizes the chance for those holes of lining up so that something egregious can get through. And so that's what we're relying on a manual process. And so what we try to do in order to mitigate the risk of a bad event happening by adding additional steps in the review process.
Senator Morse.
Thank you. My comments tailgate somewhat Representative Benstis, but I'm looking at the number of cases per year, and in my mind there's an incongruity in that I recall, at least in the Senate, we had a presentation where we were looking at tax compliance and we were looking at data on a national basis for income tax filers. And as I recall that, and Paul and Senator Burdick, maybe your memory is better than mine, but we had, I mean, it was just a large number of actual, fraud, non-compliance, put it that way. And in fact, one business sector, as I recall, it was, you know, something in excess of 50% of the returns were non-compliant. And then we're in a financial stress in our budget, and then we're reducing and we're cutting back. And my question is, and this is a kind of a broad policy question, is have we given you the resources that you need to not just process, but look at tax compliance issues to make certain that, I mean, if we're looking at 400 to 500, 600 identified non-compliance cases, when the evidence nationally for income tax filers is just over a number far in excess of that, are we supporting you in the way that we should? And what should we be doing? And I think that's really what this whole issue maybe brings up, mm-hmm. is a review in terms of your capabilities and what should we be doing? That would be my question.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Morse, this I think goes to another piece of Representative Bence's question that I should have responded to. You give us a lot of resources every year to do the job. And so we do try to balance the resources that you give us for the job that we have to do. Now, is there more that we could do? Absolutely. There is a tax gap. And I would say that at some point you reach a point of diminishing returns where you give us an additional dollar and we can't buy back that dollar. But I don't know where it is. I don't know where that diminishes. I do know that we haven't hit it yet. And so if you wanted to give us additional resources, we could do more with it. I would say, though, that part of our job at the Department of Revenue and part of what we try to do is balance the resources that you do give us to make sure that we're putting it into the things that are most effective. I would say, generally, you do give us enough resource to be able to do the job. It's incumbent on us, and I would say that, and that was part of the remarks that I had made earlier about prioritizing the work, where we haven't done the job that we needed to be able to, or that we needed to do in prioritizing those dollars to make sure that they're going after the things that are most important. We do a couple of different things at the department. We have part of our resource that goes to short-term revenue generation, because we know that's something that's very important. Part of it goes to long-term revenue protection, And we're balancing that all the time to make sure that we have the proper balance, where some of the resources that we put into certain activities don't return as much as some of the other activities, but we understand that there's something greater for long-term that we're after on it. So long answer, I think, to a short question, that in general, you give us enough resource to be able to do the job. If you gave us additional resource, and I'll say this too, I don't know why previous administrations in the Department of Revenue have been as reluctant as we have been to lay out the needs for you and to show you opportunities for what you might be able to invest in within the Department of Revenue. That I've talked to folks inside revenue, and that absolutely is not going to be my philosophy. We'll take whatever resource you give us, and we'll do the best job that we have or that we can with that resource. But I think that it's incumbent on us as stewards over the revenue system to identify opportunities for you to do more if you choose to do more. And so that's what we'll be doing.
Thank you. Now, everyone else is going to get a chance, but Representative Juan, you're next. If we have covered the issue, we need to be a little mindful of our agenda, but I'm willing to go over. This is an important topic.
Thank you. We actually haven't. If I'm carrying a fragile piece of art that's worth $2.1 million across a room, I use one level of care. If I'm carrying a Tupperware glass or a Tupperware container, I use a different level of care. It is perplexing to me that the dollar amount involved is of no moment to the proper disciplinary action. And with that in mind, can you elaborate for me what exactly it takes to get to a point of termination in the Department of Revenue so that I have an understanding? Because that's the question I get asked. What does it take to get fired?
Madam Chair, Representative Wand, we have terminated people for cause. I think it's more fair to say that people have had the opportunity to resign when we presented them with evidence. And the issues that cause us to go there are issues that are black and white issues that go to intent of the employee. So it would be things like inappropriate use or inappropriate viewing of taxpayer information without a need to know. It would be things like inappropriate use of the internet. There are things that, but they all go to intent. They all go to the intent of the employee, and if there is intent of the employee to do something that they know is egregious, then that's what causes them to get fired. There, in speaking with the labor relations attorneys, they told us that there's a standard called the Any Darn Fool Standard, and it's in order to skip steps within progressive discipline and go straight to the nuclear option. It has to be something that any darn fool would not have done. And so that's, in our incident, it wasn't intentional negligence. They were mistakes, and there were poor judgment in the decisions that were made, but nobody intentionally set out to do something egregious. And so that's the standard that we use. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Reed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for being here. I want to echo the comments that Senator Haas and Representative Bence made, but my question's on a different topic, and it really builds on what Senator Morse was talking about. In fact, I was debating whether or not to try to politely interrupt when you're asking your question, because I have in front of me an old report from the Department of 2009 on income tax compliance, which references 2006 tax year, and it puts the net tax gap at that point of almost $1.25 billion. So I know we're short on time, so now may not be the exact time, but I would like to hear more about your plans on how to stick to that highest ROI measure and what plans you have to close that tax gap, particularly if I understood you correctly earlier to say that we are giving you enough money, enough resources to do that. That's a large gap that we'd like to spend in other ways.
And I think what I'm hearing is that that you should be prepared to address this probably in a committee meeting at a later date, correct?
Madam Chair, we're
going to let you wing that.
Right.
Too important.
Thank you. May I just say that I didn't mean that we got that we are given enough resource to be able to address that entire $1.2 billion tax gap. What I was saying was, or what I was trying to say was, that the resources that you give us are probably on a par with the resources that other states give to their revenue agencies. Every state that has an income tax has a tax gap. Every state has a tax gap, and nobody puts enough dollars in it to be able to shrink that tax gap to zero. And so that's where I say, if you gave us additional dollars, we absolutely would be able to give you a positive ROI. But the dollars that you do give us are adequate if you're looking at us in relation to other state agencies. So thank you for the opportunity to clarify.
Madam Chair, I appreciate the clarification. I think I'm safe in saying that this committee is interested in where those positive ROI opportunities are.
Absolutely, we are. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have really 2 points, and I've just added a third one. I'm interested in understanding whether the people who are now responsible for administering those filters that you were describing are the people who have the capacity and the will to actually use them. Now, In dealing with returns like the one that we've been discussing.
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, are you asking if the filter...
Let me back up. When you and I discussed this issue earlier, and I think you've discussed this with other members of the committee, one of the things that you told me was that there was one person who simply made an error, probably the first filter.
Yes.
There were three other people who did not execute the filter that they were supposed to execute. I think that's a fair way of saying what you told me. I'm hoping that your answer to my question is, yeah, I've got people in place now who will execute the filters that they're supposed to execute correctly.
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, we do. And that's how we've caught the fraud or intercepted the fraud that we have and identified the $37 million in net adjustments that are non-fraud within that particular unit. Now, there are mistakes that are made, and this one was a huge one, and so understandably it's getting the attention, and people are concerned that we don't treat it seriously or don't have the controls in place to be able to stop it. But that's what I tried to convey, that I do have confidence that the group that is looking at this and is tasked with this particular responsibility within the department is taking it seriously and is doing the job that they're supposed to be doing with this.
Even though they were not doing it at the time.
Even though they didn't do it for this particular incident.
And I, following up on this issue, it's also my understanding that at least one of the people who was very instrumental in the need to execute these kinds of filters is no longer working in that chain and is doing something else that requires a different level of expertise and a different level of training.
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, that's correct.
But more in concert with what that person's capable of.
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, that's correct.
Okay, thank you. Second topic, criminal prosecutions. Somebody who files a false tax return intentionally has committed a crime, yes?
Yes.
What are you doing about that? Is anybody going to jail?
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, we are actively pursuing where we can. I'm reluctant to explain why this particular incident
what's different on the record. There are differences in the types of fraud attempts that we get. Some of them are harder to pin down than others. I'll say it that way. Where we have opportunity to look at it, we are partnering with Department of Justice to pursue that. So this is something that we're working on. We fully recognize that we would get a ripple or a bump from publishing in the paper that we've caught somebody else. That obviously, when something like this gets through, there is I guess incentive for other people to try it. When something doesn't get through and there are bad consequences to the people that are trying making the attempt, I think there's a ripple there too, and less people do it. So we are looking at it and trying to identify what we can, but just know that there are challenges, and I don't want to get on the record what those challenges are.
No, that's fine. I'm not interested in giving people who commit fraud a blueprint about how to do it, and I understand that, your point. A final set of questions really has to do with the sets of things that others have already raised. People from your department have testified many times in front of this committee that additional resources properly applied would raise more money than we spent. But then we give you in order to apply that additional effort. Is that still true?
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, I think it is still true.
Right. So if we gave you a given sum of dollars, you would return to us that sum of dollars plus more in additional compliance.
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, that's true. I think that is true.
And see, in my view, that's a comment on the legislature, not on the department. It is our responsibility to make sure you have the resources that you need, your job to see that they get applied correctly so that they actually do lead to those kind of results, and I really appreciate that answer.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think I would agree with you in part, but I do think that it is part of our stewardship responsibility to present the opportunities to you and give you the opportunity to say yes or no to it. So I think there's probably a mutual...
Thank you.
There are issues on both sides there's work on both sides that's necessary in order to make that happen.
Madam Chair, then I assume that we can expect that some will be forthcoming.
I'm sure it will.
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, we're working on it as we speak.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Senator Burdick, your cleanup.
Okay. Well, first of all, I want to say how much I appreciate your candor and your transparency and your outreach to the committee, both here and individually. As soon as this came up, we really appreciate it. The communication has been very good. And also, I'm sympathetic with your situation. This incident happened in January. You became director in March, and everything blew up in May. So you, that needs to be part of the record. You have, to your great credit, you have not tried to dodge any kind of responsibility, and you've taken full responsibility for what happens going forward. So my question has to do with going forward in a little bit different way. I mean, I concur with the comments that were made by my colleagues, Senator Haas, Senator Morris, Representative Benz in particular. But going forward, in today's paper, Michelle Cole in the Oregonian quoted one employee as saying that she felt it was acceptable to simply not do her job. She had different words, but just basically auto-approving things when her job was not to auto-approve. And then in the same story, the manager, which it sounded like it was her manager, was afraid to, had heard rumors that she might be doing that, and was afraid to confront her for fear of ruffling her feathers. Now, to me, that says, and when you combine that to reports that I've received about poor morale in the department, and which I think other members of the committee have received like that, I see an employee, a lower-level employee who feels alienated, isolated, and doesn't care about her job. I see a manager who doesn't feel like he has the support to do his job, and I see a very significant cultural sickness within the department, just from the, you know, just from what I hear and from those two quotes in the paper today. And I believe that cultural direction comes from on top. This is not to excuse the employee. I think there's no question that this employee would have been out that very same day, any place in the private sector, and probably deserved to be out of the job. So I'm not defending that employee, but to me it speaks to a bigger cultural problem in the department, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that, whether you see that, and what your plans are to address that.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, I would say that I agree with you that we had people that weren't doing their jobs at several levels, and that is that. It's difficult because we can look at this and look at that incident, and I would hate, in spite of the issues that Representative Gelser had with her constituent, I'd hate to say that we can look at this and draw a conclusion that everybody in the Department of Revenue doesn't care about their job. I honestly, the people at the Department of Revenue, I am very proud to work with them. They understand our role in state government. They understand that the work that we do is important, not because of the work we do, but because of what the work that we do supports in the rest of state government. They get that, and they understand their role there. And so the vast majority of the people at the Department of Revenue are conscientious, are hardworking, and people that take their stewardship or their roles within the stewardship responsibility of the Department of Revenue seriously. And so I would agree with you that there are issues, that there are cracks in the Department of Revenue in that regard. I think that I will say that the lack of permanent leadership at the Department of Revenue for so long, I think, contributed to that. I do think that we're on a good path at the Department of Revenue to correcting the issues that you've noted and that others here have noted. But I would not draw the conclusion that because we had a couple of people who didn't do their job that is something that's characteristic across the board at the Department of Revenue, because that isn't the case.
If I could just follow up, but let me try this a different way. What are you doing to try to improve communications and improve kind of mission communications with your employees? Because when something like this happens, you know, I just don't think it happens in a vacuum. And I totally agree that most of the employees, you know, at least from what, all you have to do is look at the frauds that you do catch. I mean, people are out there doing their job and doing it very well. But when something like this happens, it's a canary in a coal mine. And to me, it says lack of mission communication to the employees, lack of knowledge about, I mean, if you've got an employee there who cares so little about her job that she just simply doesn't do it, the fact that nobody saw that and flagged that is a big problem, even if it's only one employee. So that's really the nature of my question, is what is being done from the top to try to improve the morale, the mission communication, and the cohesiveness, right, of the organization.
Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, that is something that we've recognized or that we are addressing at our leadership level. And I think I'll touch on a couple of things that we're doing. For, I would say, a number of years now, we've gotten away at the Department of Revenue from truly engaging staff and having staff be a part of the process, that bubble up the ideas that get implemented. And I don't want to say that we've shut it off entirely, I think particularly between my deputy and me, we've recognized that that's something that we need to get back to, that engaging employees is something that's going to keep people involved in the process and sharp at doing their job. So that's one thing. The other thing that we're doing, I think, is we're focusing a little bit. I talked a little bit about the prioritization of the work that we do, but one of the other mistakes that I believe we've made over the past couple of years in particular is we have layered direction on staff. We a few years back, we did some really good work, I think, on identifying the mission and vision and goals of the Department of Revenue. And then instead of working on those goals and spending our opportunity, we started in another direction and layered another different direction on staff, and it became, I think, confusing to people, and it's almost like shiny object syndrome, where we can't not pick up a shiny object. We couldn't just work in the direction that we'd given staff. And so one of the things that we absolutely are committed to doing at our leadership level is focusing for the Department of Revenue. We're stripping away much of the layers of direction that we've identified for folks, and we're drilling down to four specific outcome areas so people know exactly what it is that we want them to focus on. People can focus on four outcome areas. They can't focus on 40. And so there's a recognition that a lot of what we're doing contributed to that. And then lastly, I'd say we are committed to transparency, particularly with our employees. We've increased the amount of information that we're giving staff. I have monthly emails or periodic emails where I update people. We have monthly town halls where people get together, everybody in Department of Revenue. We typically have something that we want to present, but we also just open it up for general questions from people, and those have been very well received. We're increasing the connection. I've started a video blog, a director's video blog that I do every couple of weeks, and that's not in my wheelhouse, but it's something that I think is important for people in order to increase the connection. I think too that one of the other things that we're doing is we're hiring again. We had several a lot of vacancy in the Department of Revenue because we had a lot of specific things that we were having to address in our budget. Everybody's had the shortfalls in budget cuts, and we're no different. And we also had a pretty significant budget note that went to readiness for the system. And in order to fund those, because we're 85% personal services, we had to hold vacancies. That's caused a problem with staff, where additional work has been applied on them because they're having to do the jobs of more people, and we're hiring again. And so I think again, a long answer to a short question, but I think that you're going to start seeing some changes in Department of Revenue, and you're not going to hear the issues that you've been hearing from us.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm not going to pile on here except to reiterate my comments would echo Senator Briggs. I am very aware of this cultural issue within this agency, that this is an agency under great stress. It is incumbent on you and your leadership team to bring us out of this. The stakes are incredibly high for the state. The stakes are incredibly high for taxpayers who dutifully interact with your agency, not because they really want to, right, but because they are required to, and that's another burden on you, and I understand that. So I will look forward to you coming forward with a vision of how this culture is going to change, along with corrective actions, and then we'll work with you to move this agency forward. We want it to work. It's the most important agency in state government as far as I'm concerned from where I sit. That's where I started, and that's where we're going to end. Thank you.
Fair enough. Thank you for the partnership.
Thank you. Committee members, we're just a little bit behind, and Vince Porter is here and next on our agenda to give us an update on the video tax credit auction. Sorry, Vince, that you're, come on up. You're just a little bit behind. We'll try and catch up as we go. Thank you, Jim.
Madam Chair, thank you for the time. I believe I gave to Chris the worksheet that we prepared based on the information we got from the Department of Revenue on the tax credit auction that was held in July. And, you know, I think all in all it was we were very satisfied with the results. Just to go through quickly a few of the highlights of what the data showed. We did have a total of $6 million of credits. The total bids, the process, just to be really quick, the process that we established with Department of Revenue is that taxpayers would submit a bid online to the Department of Revenue, and then they would have essentially about a week to turn in bankable funds to secure that bid. And then from that point, the highest bidders would win, and we would filter on down till we maxed out the $6 million. We did, on the initial bid process, have more than $6 million of bids that came through. Unfortunately, one very high bid did not come through with the money, and so we did dip below the full $6 million, and that's why we only sold $6.7 million of tax credits. Good news is we did, the average rate was above what our lowest, what our baseline was, which was 95%. The average rate was 97.7. I was curious, I'm not exactly sure, but the highest winning bid actually bid as high as 121%. And then also here is just a few details about the highest bid that was secured and then also the lowest. We are going to have a second auction. We've already worked with Department of Revenue to do this in roughly 3 weeks. That will be a shorter amount to sell out the remaining $331,000 of credits. And we're, based on the information we've reached out to various people, we're hopeful and pretty confident that we'll sell out the remaining.
Thank you. Questions of the committee. I forgot to ask Chris to kind of vet us on how this program works, but I think you're pretty much familiar, so I'm trying to get ahead of it. Representative Wine, you had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Porter, what's the current economic impact numbers that you have on this program for this year?
Madam Chair, Representative Wand, our audits based on the projects that we bring in for this program, well, the total amount of film and video that we audited amounted to over $130 million last year in 2011. Some of that did not go towards OPIF. It was just secured by the other program, Green Light Labor Rebate. So total amount was just over $110 million. The good news is, with the projects that are work going on right now, and we've had a few additional, we expect to at least match that, maybe even slightly increase it in 2012.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. Before we started this auction, we used a different method for selling these credits. That if you were still using that other method, you would have raised considerably less for actual investment in film and video than what you've actually raised even so far, even without selling it all. Isn't that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, yes, that is correct. I mean, had we not done the auction, I think our intention was to sell at 95%. So the fact that we went 2.7 over that already, we've done better. I admit I was concerned about how we were going to effectively communicate the auction and get people to understand how it was going to work, but it did, and I'm grateful that it did.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To follow up on Representative Wan's question, we lost a series because we had reached the cap on the on the tax credit, do you have any idea of how much economic activity would have been present if we'd been able to fund it?
Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, we on average, well, I'll start with we've had a tremendous amount of interest in the last, I would say, about 18 months, and it's I definitively know one television series. We average probably one to two very serious calls that are range anywhere from we're starting in a month, what do you have, to we're in our early stages. A television series like the one that I imagine you're referring to probably would have amounted to $20 to $25 million a year.
Representative Reed, no. Further questions? Just a comment. Following up, you indicated we could get more if we invested more. At what point is always the question, is that a diminishing return? And if this is an industry that has to be subsidized, what is its value ultimately if you withdraw the subsidy? This committee has gone through that a lot. How are we doing nationally in terms of getting this compared to, say, other competitors for this kind of business?
Madam Chair, I think we do really well in the context of what we're up against in terms of the competition. States like Louisiana and Georgia have made a much larger commitment, and they often offer quite a bit more money per project than anything that we do. So I think given the context of what we have to work with and how we're able to take advantage of other advantages, just close proximity to California and just a strong creative base, I think we've done really, really well, and definitely proud of what's been accomplished so far.
Yes.
Madam Chair, your question did prompt me to have another thought, and maybe that's where you were thinking,
yeah,
I was going to go. The piece that has always been interesting to me is to think about what our real competitive advantage is in this place. And I know, Vince, I hope I'm not putting you on the spot here, but it might be worth telling the committee about some of the work you've been doing as a proposal with Oregon Inc. That builds on what I think it's fair to say a competitive advantage opportunity.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Reed. I think he knows this is a particular passion of mine. I think there's two obvious sectors in our state that are very strong and becoming more intertwined, and that's the creative community, the Wieden and Kennedys, and other design firms, and also the strong creative class that's out there producing these projects. But we also have a really great tech community, more and more you're seeing, with the example of Wieden and Kennedy establishing their tech incubator, Portland Incubator Experiment, but also across the state. Southern Oregon University has an emerging media department now. We've put a proposal forth with the idea of creating basically a digital content incubator that would be much aligned with what Oregon Inc.'s goals are. It would require a small amount of investment, and then looking for co-ventures with companies like Intel that are currently being solicited by states from all over the country to invest in these various efforts. And, I was thinking about this today. We're doing a great job building data centers, and my industry is now becoming very reliant on those data centers to run their content through there. And it would be great to see our data centers being filled with projects being produced here in Oregon.
Hallelujah to that.
Synergy.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the brevity and getting this back close to.
Thank you.
On time. Thanks for coming in. Next, we have a background on rural medical tax credit from the Office of Rural Health. And preamble here.
Just to remind the committee, the rural medical tax credit is a $5,000 credit to medical professionals with the intent providing medical services to rural parts of the state.
Okay.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Scott Ekblad. I'm the director of the Oregon Office of Rural Health, which is located at Oregon Health and Science University. And hopefully the technology will work today. I figured I'd mix it up a little bit and give you a PowerPoint presentation.
Okay.
But I promise it won't last too long.
Before us, so you can go fairly
right.
Quickly.
So for those who are a little less familiar, the tax credit's been around for quite some time and began with tax year 1990. That only certain professions are eligible for this particular tax credit. They've been added at different times. That originally it was physicians, physician assistants, and nurse practitioners, and then other professions have been added in subsequent legislative sessions. There was at one time a 10-year limit for how long you could claim the credit. That limit was removed in 1999. The requirements for eligibility for physicians is different than that of nurse practitioners and of dentists, and it just depended upon the legislation that was passed at the time. But for all the providers, at least 60% of their practice must be spent in a rural community, and for that they can be eligible for up to $5,000 in the state income tax credit. Rural, for the purposes of this program, and there really, I hope you understand when I say there is no one definition of rural. It's more a matter of eligibility criteria for a particular program. They just differ all over the place. But for this program, it is at least 10 miles from a community of 40,000 or more. So this is what it looks like for Oregon. Everything that is red or yellow up there would be considered urban. Everything that's a shade of green is rural. The dark green counties, we have 10 counties in the state of Oregon, they're considered frontier. And by frontier, we use the federal definition, that's 10 or excuse me, six or fewer people per square mile. All right. In 2011, about 2,000 people received the credit. And as you can tell, over half of those were physicians. Recently, actually, we're in the midst of it now, the Oregon Rural Health Association and our office surveyed tax credit recipients. In anticipation of the sunset that's soon to be before us. The survey was sent last Monday, and as of this Monday, over 900 people have responded. It's, depending upon how you go about counting them, it's about 950 people actually had already responded. So very good response rate. This is a breakdown of the folks who did respond so far to the survey. We are doing another reminder, and we'll give them another week to fill it out. But at this point, as you can tell, the vast majority are physicians, MDs or DOs. The breakdown of those who responded, you can see that just over a third have been receiving it 5 years or less, just less than a third, 6 to 10 years, and about a third, 11 or more years. But here's really the meat of the questions that we asked, and this one is, how significant was the tax credit in your decision to practice in rural Oregon? And as you can tell, over 700 of the 950 folks said it was either very important or important. We also asked them, and I have abbreviated the questions here for this particular presentation a little bit, so I'll explain. We asked them, in your community, as you're going about your recruitment and retention activities for your community, not necessarily specific to you, do you think that the tax credit's been more valuable as a recruitment tool or as a retention incentive? And interestingly, obviously the vast majority here feel it's best as a retention incentive. And I think if I were to just throw in some conjecture here, I think that's probably because it started as $5,000 a year in 1990. It's still $5,000 a year, so it's probably not enough to make someone move to rural Oregon, but certainly plays a factor in them staying. Also, this is really a combination of two questions, so let me explain a little bit. We first asked, would you continue to practice in rural Oregon if recipients of the credit were required to practice a minimum number of hours per week in rural Oregon? And the vast majority of those folks said yes. So there was a follow-up that said, if so, what's the minimum hours that you think you would need to work in rural Oregon in order to qualify for the credit? So this is how it breaks down. 10 hours a week, 20 hours a week, and interestingly, the majority feel that you have to work half-time or more in order to be eligible for the credit. And the reason we ask this is because there are folks who work primarily in an urban area but maybe work one day a week in a rural community, or they're partially retired and they only work one day or something. We also asked if you were to continue to practice in rural Oregon, or would you continue to practice in rural Oregon if you were required to accept, or in other words, keep your practice open to the same percentage of Medicare and Medicaid patients as exists in your county. We only have countywide data. So, for example, we would go, and this is what we do for the medical malpractice subsidy program, if you're familiar with that. But we send out an application that says, okay, you're in Lane County. Lane County has X percentage of Oregon Health Plan patients and X percentage of Medicare patients. You must attest to the fact that you'll keep your practice open to that many patients. And they were very much in support of that idea. Also, what would the impact be on your decision to continue practicing in rural Oregon if the credit were limited? And you could see that almost 350 said it would make them consider leaving. Also, more than 250 said it would make them begin looking for other opportunities. Frankly, I'm a little bit surprised at that one. How about if the credit were eliminated altogether? About the same level of response. The final question was open-ended and offered an opportunity to provide feedback. I was truly overwhelmed and am a long ways from getting my brain wrapped around all the responses. First of all, it's an incredibly good response rate for 1 week of a survey. And for 250 to enter in text open-ended question is really amazing. But I can tell you that the overwhelming majority talk about how, okay, it's not a make or break amount of money, but it's a gesture on the part of the state that the state acknowledges that they're working probably longer hours for less money and, you know, doing after hours call every night of the week and et cetera, et cetera. And some also mention that it does take a step to address the urban-rural pay differential. And with that, that's all that I can share from the survey.
Next year.
Yes. Happy to answer any questions. Yes.
I thank you very much for this. I simply wanted to comment that for at least one legislator, the results of this survey is important to the issue of whether or not we extend this credit next year. So, I mean, to the extent that that might be useful in goading people into responding, you have my permission to say that at least one of us thinks this survey is important for our determination as to whether we extend it or not.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Barnhart, thank you. And I do have to admit we did allude to that fact. Yeah.
Further questions from others? Yeah.
Chair, do you have any breakdown of medical professionals who get the credit? For example, the requirements are pretty loose. Like, you only have to be 10 miles away. So if you live in Portland, you could practice in Boring, maybe. I think that's 10 miles away. And so it's basically a commute for some people. And so I'd like to get a sense of, you know, I think when most people think of the rural tax credit, they're thinking of somebody out there in Harney County, you know, where in a very medically deprived situation, and right, as being probably the highest and best use of the tax credit.
Madam Chair and Senator Burdick, we could certainly come up with a more detailed description of where the recipients are. I can only add that it's 10 miles from a population center, 40,000. So it might be 10 miles from Forest Grove, or it might be 10 miles from one of the suburbs, from Gresham or something like that. And secondly, I'll be the first to acknowledge that there is certainly degrees of rural.
Right. And so we're gonna be needing to parse that out, yes, in a limited budget environment.
Sure. Yeah, we're easily able to do that.
I believe we've grappled with it before. I think we're going to grapple with it again.
We definitely are.
Those of us remember. Further questions? Thank you, Scott. This
You're
was
very welcome.
Very informative. Quick work on getting this data to us. If
My pleasure.
Very timely, and we appreciate you coming in. We will. That will be to be continued, as you all know. We're now ahead of schedule, committee members, and I see no reason not to keep going because the next agenda item is background on the Manufacturing Business Energy Tax Credit, and we have folks from Business Oregon. Welcome, Tim.
Thank you.
And another topic that may take a little more time. So I don't think we need any staff on this, so we'll let you proceed.
Co-Chair Berger, Barnhart, Chair Burdick, and members of the committee, thanks for taking the time today to review the Manufacturing Betsy Tax Credits. For the record, I'm Tim McCabe, Director of the Business Development Department. And Chris, did you make copies of that? I just want to get right into it. I know I brought the source code with me today so we can fact check what I'm saying here. You know. But I gave you about three handouts here, and the first one I want to talk about, and I want to just get right into the actual figures of the Betsy and what's happened or transpired since its inception in 2008. On this Excel spreadsheet, what I'd like you to pay special attention to is the bottom line, where it goes from 2008, 2009, 2010, and 2011. Those represent the Betsys that have actually transpired in this period. So as you can see, the actual Betsys that have been issued for the past 4 years total $38,605,000. And the total number of Betsys that have been certified for final certification is $90,998,000. I only bring that up, and again, I'm not going to refer to this story, but the perception out there is we've given hundreds of millions of dollars in Betsys, when in fact, to date, each of these Betsys that's been issued, you can only do 20% of them in any given year, so it's phased out over a five-year period. So to date, we've given out $38 million in Betsys. Okay. I wanted to make that point first. The second thing I'd like you to take a look at, it's a second sheet, and it says on the front, it says 2007 through 2011 impact. It's this one. It's a Business Oregon logo, and down here it says 2007 to 2011 economic impact summary. What we did, I had my economist, Michael Myers, do what we call an in-plan study on the direct jobs created by the industry, the indirect jobs that supply the industry. These are suppliers. A good example of an indirect job right here in this building, why they add jobs, is the cafeteria downstairs. When you're in session, they bring more people in because they become very much busier, obviously. When you're not in session, there's not as many people in that cafeteria, and there's not as many employees. The same holds true for a company like SolarWorld. They've hired somebody to come in and be their cafeteria manager. They've got 1,000 employees in there. So these are the direct impacts that this company makes. That's the indirect effect. The direct effect is the obvious, the payroll directly to the employees. And the induced effect is the employees spending this money in the community, going to the theater, doing all these other things and spending the money, thereby helping to create and maintain jobs. I bring that up because everybody always asks the question, what's direct, indirect, and induced? And those are the simplest terms. So if you go to page 2, page 1 actually summarizes the total amount of revenue, but I had Michael break it down by year since the inception so you can get a visual. And the reason I do that is because, again, if you read the paper and you think about it just in total sum of the incentives that are giving, the stories would say the state's still on the hook for $42 million. Well, the fact is it's not. Because of the jobs and the indirect and induced effect, in 2008, our estimates are that the state realized $2,075,000 in revenue over that period of time, while the Betsy, again, it's not at a break-even point, but we issued $4 million in Betsys during that same period. And again, you go through each year, we've taking it year by year, 2009, $4,119,000, $6.1 million in Betsy's. In 2010, the revenue totaled $8 million, and we had $14 million in Betsy's. And the same in 2011, we've done even better. As you can see, we realized $11,400,000 in taxes and issued $14,199,000. So I guess what's disconcerting to me, unlike some of the other incentives, there's a return on this investment. It's not just something we give out and don't get anything in return. And I might add that these 1,000 jobs that Intel's had in this recessionary period were greatly needed. So the Betsy was a good incentive at the time. Now, having said that, I firmly believe this incentive is running its course. It's industry specific around renewable energy, and it's based on, initially it was based on investment rather than jobs, and I think it's time for you and us to help you do that, is to reassess this incentive and retool it to make it a more effective tool that can be applied to existing Oregon companies, as well as a recruitment tool to bring companies in. Some of you have read probably in the Oregonian about Salesforce, the software company out of San Francisco. We've worked with that company for over a year. But the one thing that tipped the scales, and without talking about the amounts today because we haven't finalized the contract, is the business expansion program that was introduced last year in the last session for $4 million. Okay. Huge thing for us to have that. This incentive didn't apply to them. Without that incentive, that company doesn't happen. So with that, you know, that's just an overview of what's happened over the past 4 years, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The data, you know, assuming the data is correct, and I'm assuming for this discussion that it is, it's really a large return on a tax credit if the business is sustainable. Because if you jumpstart it, get it here, and then over time, that employment base continues, you know, and hopefully it grows. What is your feeling about the sustainability, which has been the big issue around SOAR, specific to this tax credit?
Senator Morris, co-chairs, members of the committee, that's a very good question. When this incentive was introduced in the 2007 session, Senator Burdick was on the committee as well as Representative Barnhart. This incentive at the time, the solar industry was, I think, a very good idea. The governor's office, and I was in the governor's office at the time, was very supportive of it. We saw a growth industry. It wasn't a haphazard guess. We talked to the 5 largest manufacturers in the world at the time and asked them, what are your plans for the future? Do you plan to expand? And if so, do you plan to expand in North America? And all 5 said yes to both questions. So it wasn't as though we created something that we didn't think could be successful. And in my estimation, Senator, it's been very successful. But getting to your point, we couldn't have foreseen at that time what the industry was going to look like 4 years later. And my feeling is what we've done in the department is we've actually stopped recruitment in the solar industry for the past year. We have not actively gone out and sought companies other than suppliers for our existing companies, knowing that the industry is in flux right now. And we're being very supportive of Solar World and Sanyo and the companies we've got here to do everything we can to help them sustain the jobs that they currently have. I don't know the answer. We're hoping that our opinion is that when all is said and done, there's going to be 3 or 4 major manufacturers in the world, and we're hoping that we have 2 of those. You know, China's going to have an effect on these, but Solar World's done, along with Sanyo's support, the right things in introducing those tariffs and that. So we're about 8 to 16 months out before we'll know. But our intent always when we recruit someone is to hope that they're going to be here for the long haul.
Yes, to follow up, thank you, Madam Chair. To follow up on that point, first of all, I want to commend your department for taking the sideboards that we put into the law, and Representative Barnhart and I were directly in the room when this section of the Betsy was written. But you took those sideboards and you actually strengthened them, and I think you've done a really good job of doing your due diligence in recruiting. I don't think we've been suckered by a lot of people since you've been managing this credit. But my question is, just to refresh us on, I think whenever you have an incentive program like this, and I think the Solar World story, regardless of its accuracy or inaccuracy, did point up the importance of having some sort of clawback provision if the contract, if the people who come in don't live up to what they commit to when they get the credit. So if you could just refresh us on what the statute has in terms of clawback and further things that you're doing in the department to protect us, to protect the taxpayers, and how this might apply or what changes you might recommend, especially if we broaden out the tax credit.
Okay. Chair Burdick, co-chairs, members of the committee, the addition, that we put in two actually, production and jobs. And those jobs are also tied to the wages. They have to be in excess of 100% of the wages in the area. So there's a number of jobs, the wages, and the production that's coming out of the plant. The production is proprietary. We're not at liberty to release that because each company has its own way of producing these wafers. So they don't like their competitors knowing what they're doing. So, but having said that, Solar World, which is the one of most interest because it was in the paper, has made all of its production, all of its employment for the past 2 years. Now, what comes into question is what happens in the future. And really, the clawbacks are based on what will happen with Solar World. Obviously, if they were to close down, those clawbacks will be significant. But if they're forced to reduce workforce, we prorate them because oftentimes this is through no fault of their own. The industry is dictating right now what's happening to them. So if they have to do a reduction in workforce to stay alive, we have to be understanding of that. Okay, so there is some given that. But the biggest clawback comes if they close their doors. The money comes back depending on how and how far out they are and how large the incentive's been.
And follow up, Madam Chair, do you think it's adequate? I mean, do you think it's effective? Do you think it's strong enough? Or do you think as we move forward that we should look at strengthening those clawback provisions?
I think what we, Senator and members of the committee, I think what we need to do is look at the whole program and not just the clawback incentives. What I recommend is on the business expansion program, what we do, it's based on 2 years' revenue to the state. This is personal income tax revenue. They're required to hire 50 people at 150% of the average wage in the area or the state, whichever is lower. Then they receive upfront 2 years' worth of personal income tax revenue as an incentive to come to Oregon. But they have to sign on to hire as many people as they said, and they have to have those people for that two-year period, so the state gets 100% of its money back. So I think in answer to your question, what I would recommend and what I would encourage you to give us the leeway to take a look and make some recommendations to you how to expand that program and show a positive return on investment. The way we've got the BEP structured, if they leave at any time in that first 2 years, they have to give us 100% of the money back. So it truly is an incentive that says to them, either you're going to come here, and we're going to give you this if you come here, but you've got to stay for at least the 2 years so we get all of our money back. And after that, obviously, as Senator Morris was asking, the state's making money. And I think we should base all of our incentives on the return on investment to the state. I think the manufacturing Betsy was a great incentive for its time, but being based solely initially on investment, it didn't take into account all these other things. We've done it since then, but I think going forward, we have to look at the state's well-being going beyond, not just what we're giving the company.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Yes.
Just very quickly, you know, when we started this project in 2007, we couldn't distinguish between the installation of devices designed to generate power on the one hand and conservation and manufacturing jobs on the other. And this differential that we've adopted since then, the criteria that you're suggesting makes a huge amount of sense for that. It occurred to me as you were talking in the last couple of sentences that we ought to be considering the environmental impact in terms of improving the environment, but that's a different program. This program is around building the economy in Oregon in a way that's long-term sustainable, that increases high-wage jobs, and gets us on the path for long-term recovery. And I think you're right on track, and I'm very, very interested in looking forward to the changes you're going to suggest so we can maintain that goal.
Great. Thank you, Representative.
To that end, Chris, this is on our list for next.
Yes, this is one of the credits that sunsets at the end of 2013.
So this, again, is timely, and we will be working with you.
Great.
Make it stronger and get more jobs.
Look forward to it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think we are getting to the end. Paul, you want to talk about the business of the committee? I don't know about you guys, but it's been a long morning.
It has been.
Productive morning.
Very interesting morning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very interesting.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the last thing I had on the agenda was this committee bill draft request process discussion. And just to remind you of the process we're going through, and our deadlines have been moved up from what we've seen previously. I know the Senate President sent out a memo to everyone yesterday that the deadline now is September 17th, which would be the Monday following your legislative days. You do have a committee meeting scheduled. The House and Senate committees will actually be meeting separately but unfortunately, you've both got the 8 o'clock slot. So Thursday, the 13th, will be House Revenue, 8 to 11. And then Friday, the 14th, will be Senate Finance and Revenue from 8 to 11. So that will give you another opportunity to talk about what kinds of bills you want to request at the committee level. I have a running tab now, a running list. So keep those ideas through the chairs, and then I will. What I'm going to do is when I'm complete with that, is to review those with the chairs and make those decisions probably that Thursday or Friday of the legislative days, and then we'll make sure everything is into council by Monday the 17th.
So I think the call is out to. If you have suggestions for committee bills, now is the time between now, really, and the next legislative days to sort of feed those ideas into Paul's office or to your chairs, either way, and we'll make some final decisions then.
Well, one thing we have done, Madam Chair, is we have we're just proceeding the way we did last session around the sunset. You've had the first two credits that are scheduled for sunset discussed here this morning, and we're going to go ahead and introduce, and the plan now is to introduce in both chambers just a straight extension. So it'll be just a straight 6-year extension, and those would serve as the vehicles for your discussion, and then presumably get those to policy committees that would then go on to the joint committee.
Okay.
Right. Yep. If I may, a quick comment. The September 17th deadline is not only for committee bill draft requests, but also for member bill draft requests for both the Senate and the House, if I understand correctly.
Right.
And that being the case, I think this is a comment to all members of both chambers. There are two paths that a bill draft request can come. One is through the committees, and then Paul's addressed that. The other, of course, is that members can request bill drafts of their own with the understanding that any member can introduce that bill later, or the member can ask the committees to introduce the bill as committee bills. I haven't discussed this with Representative Berger, but it was always my assumption that bills that relate to revenue, regardless of what the committee chairs think of as the merits of the bill, are available for bill introduction by the committee at the time that that's appropriate, sometime in December. I forget the exact date. At the request of members. Now, I haven't talked about that with Representative Berger, so I don't know if she's ready to go there or not.
We've been comfortable about that.
We've been comfortable about that in the past, and I think we still are. That was originally, of course, started by Representative Shetterly back in 2003, I think, and the committee's followed that ever since. So even if you haven't gotten an idea to the committee administrator, but you get it in yourself, that there's still another stage at which you can get a committee bill introduced.
Anything else for the good of the order, Paul?
Just in terms of the schedule, we will have that, as Representative Barnhart was referring, the December Legislative Days meeting. That'll be when you can pre-session introduce
when
bills.
When is the... anybody remember off the top of their head?
I'll have the exact
date. December...
Teens, I think.
Okay, teens. Good, because I have plans.
You also will have a meeting on, I believe, November 21st for the December revenue forecast. So,
okay. Right.
So you'll have the September meetings, then you'll have two more prior to January.
Right.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. I think that I can adjourn today's interim House Revenue Committee meeting.
The Senate Finance and Revenue Committee is adjourned.
Thank you very much.